Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. 8 years ago, at the age of 27, Kim Jong-un became the supreme leader of North Korea. Since then, he has consolidated power, he's removed his father's top advisors, and he's expanded the nation's nuclear weapons program. In this program, we will seek a better understanding of Kim, how he thinks, and what might be gained from diplomacy. Joining us is Anna Fifield. She's Beijing Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, and she's the author of a new book entitled The Great Successor, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Jong-un. Moderating this program is my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
As I read the book, it's probably one of the best psychographic analyses of its leader, Kim Jong-un. It's the kind of thing that you would expect in many ways to see a CIA develop so that it can brief its State Department officials, and it provides this unique picture of someone who you probably know better than anyone else, given the years of research you've spent on this. Kim Jong-un was really destined for one of two jobs: dictator for life in North Korea, or a free agent in the NBA. And and he doesn't seem to have made it to the basketball world. So could you tell us a little bit about that journey of Kim Jong-un to the dictator for life job that seemed inevitable after reading your book?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much, Marcos, and thank you everybody for coming and listening today. You know, I have been covering North Korea since 2004 on and off, and I, you know, it's become a reporting obsession of mine. But I never thought that it could survive to a third generation. Like, from the reporting I did in the 2000s, I could just not imagine that the people would tolerate a third generation leader, that the military chief, the top brass and things would tolerate this young guy with no qualifications coming in and telling them what to do. So this really stemmed from my own questions about how has he managed to do this, and how has he managed to not just become the leader but stay the leader of North Korea. So I set out to try to report that out, which is, you know, how I do what I do. And I found several people who had known Kim Jong-un as a child, including there was a sushi chef in Japan who had moved to North Korea and had worked in the royal households for some 20 years, including when Kim Jong-un was 5, 6, 7 years old. And I talked to him on several occasions in Japan, and he told me about what life was like there in the royal compounds. So Kim Jong-un was born in 1984, and he really wanted for nothing at all. He had this very decadent childhood on the royal palaces. You know, he had all the food he could ever want. He had Lego and Super Mario games and the pianos and his own little zoo in the house. And his father even had a car modified for him so that he could reach the pedals and drive a real car at the age of 7. So he had this very abnormal childhood, and by any circumstances. But it was not only decadent, and was also very isolated. He had no friends. He did not go to school. He had tutors who came onto the compound, and he had his older brother and his younger sister, the three children from the same mother, and they were kept cloistered. They did not even know their other half-siblings. So he never knew Kim Jong-nam, his older half-brother and the first-born son of this generation. So it was a very dysfunctional family, abnormal childhood. And when he was 12 years old, he moved to Switzerland, where his older brother had gone 2 years before to Bern, the capital. His older half-brother had gone to Geneva some 10 years or so before. I mean, that shows how dysfunctional it is. They didn't even go to the same city in the same country. They were kept entirely separate. And there, he was sent there to try to give him some semblance of a normal life, to let him play basketball as he did every single day and go to school and socialize and experience a little bit of the world maybe. But even there, he had a very strange existence because partly because of language difficulties at the beginning. He was in an English language school the first 2 years, and then he transferred to a German language public school. And his classmates tell stories of him lashing out and kicking their shins and things like this because he was frustrated. He couldn't communicate. And then at 16, he went back to North Korea. And so so this information about Switzerland I got from his aunt and uncle, who went there to act as his guardians, pose as his parents in Switzerland for that time, and then defected in the middle of the night, left Kim Jong-un behind, and have been living in America for the past 20 years. And I was lucky enough to get the only ever interview with them. So I spent an entire weekend, and they told me all about what he was like as a child. But even that, you know, we know so little information about this guy that suddenly we are seizing on stories of him kicking shins or trash talking on the basketball court and these looking for any insight we can glean into the person that he has become today, because there's so little information. But I think the overall picture is that he was born for this job. He was groomed for this job from his earliest days. So he was unveiled to the regime as the great successor on his 8th birthday party. He was presented with a little general's uniform and introduced as the comrade general. And at that birthday party, where the sushi chef and the aunt were both present, real-life generals in real uniforms came in and bowed to him and saluted him. And from that day onwards, he gave orders. And as his aunt told me, it was impossible for him to grow up as a normal child from that day onwards.
Well, you're right. We are trying to glean from this very limited amount of information. And you've added to the oeuvre here, and we now have more of these data points with which to analyze and try to surmise who this person is, because he sits atop a nuclear cache of weapons. And so, and of course, the United States is engaged in a form of diplomacy, sometimes more active than others. And understanding that person and what motivates him and how he is likely to react, whether it's to diplomacy or to what we can call maximum pressure from the United States, is important. Maybe you can give us some insight into how he would or does respond to some of these diplomatic overtures and also some of these threats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, part of the reason as well that I wanted to write this is because North Korea knows so much about Donald Trump. Their officials, they have read The Art of the Deal. Their officials have read Fire and Fury, the inside book about the Trump administration. And in talks, like, they show an encyclopedic knowledge of every tweet he's ever written about North Korea. So they have a lot to be able to, like, map out Donald Trump's psychology. And from our side, I mean, I assume the CIA has more information than me, but I don't know. I can't see it.
Maybe not.
Maybe not, yeah. I mean,
it sounds like you spent an awful lot of time researching this book.
Yeah, and there's almost no human intelligence on North Korea. It's very hard target, as they say. Yes. But I think from Kim Jong-un's perspective, he views Donald Trump as an opportunity now. Like, he spent his first 5 years working on the nuclear program, pouring so much energy and money and propaganda into the system so that he could appear strong both domestically and externally. And now he is strong. He does have a credible nuclear weapons program. And it's from that position of strength that he has parlayed that now into talks, that he's come out into the outside world and trying to cut a deal with Trump, because I think he sees an opportunity. He, first of all, he has a very pro-engagement president in South Korea who's really been the put all the momentum into these talks and been the mediator there. But he knows that Donald Trump is a very unconventional American president, right? He has now seen that Trump doesn't listen to his advisors or trusts his gut instinct and prizes his ability as a master negotiator. So I think Kim Jong-un is looking at this situation and seeing a window of opportunity where the South Korean president will be out of office in 2022. Trump you know, maybe they're longer, maybe out at the end of next year. So he needs to try and cut a deal with President Trump. And he got some very good wins early on. In the Singapore summit, he had to give up nothing at all, but he got a cancellation of the military exercises between South Korea and the United States, which is astounding. I think it was astounding to many people in Japan in particular, another ally, that Donald Trump would be willing to do that. So I think, yes, he's trying to cut a deal now with Trump while Trump is there.
But even with the president giving up something like the military exercises, chances are that he's no longer going to be giving up much more in future negotiations. And the motivation for from Kim Jong-un's side is not merely for talks, it's to lower the temperature perhaps, but really to find ways to continue his rule, whether that be through getting economic favor or building relationships with neighboring countries to prevent them from being a threat to, or a perceived threat to him.
Right. Yeah, Kim Jong-un's not giving up his nuclear program. No way. Yeah. I mean, he has poured so much of himself and his leadership into that program. And remember, it was only 2 months before he took over the leadership of North Korea that Muammar Gaddafi was pulled from a ditch and then killed. And this must be seared in his brain, that this leader who cut a deal with the United States to give up his nuclear capability, you know, died in this very grisly way and was overthrown. So I cannot see a situation where he would give up everything. But maybe he'll give up something, make some token efforts, put things under lock and key. In many ways, I think it's too early to tell right now that this is, you know, something that took 30 years for them to build. It's not something that they're going to give up overnight. But also, it's such a big deal for the United States and North Korea to talk at all. There are no diplomatic relations between these countries. Every time they do talk, the stakes are so high. So I feel like they should be concentrating on trying to establish a liaison office and try to just make it easier for them to communicate. And maybe if they can reach some lower level deals or have some musical exchanges or something, there can be a confidence building mechanism whereby relations do become easier and less threatening.
Right. In the book, you mentioned that there were musical exchanges in the, and that you had attended one.
I went with the New York Philharmonic to Pyongyang in 2008. Yeah, and I felt at the time like it felt like a breakthrough. It was such a huge deal to have an American audience on a stage in Pyongyang with stars and stripes hanging there. They played the Star Spangled Banner and the North Korean anthem. So it felt like a big deal. But Kim Jong-il had a stroke that year and the plans for the succession began. So, yeah, there have been a lot of false starts with North Korea. But what I know is that the past 30 years of negotiating and carrots and sticks has not worked with them. So I do think it is time to try to be creative and try something different. I think what Kim Jong-un is looking for now, he does want economic development because the country is in such a bad state. And he knows that if he wants to stay leader for 30, 40 years to come, he needs to tend to the economy. So that's his number one goal in talking to Donald Trump. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. Like tonight, overnight our time, Xi Jinping is going to North Korea for the first time as leader. And he would not go unless he was going to get something out of Kim Jong-un. And I'm sure Kim Jong-un wants something out of him. So let's see what happens, you know, whether there could be a simple easing of sanctions implementation on the border between China and North Korea, or maybe he's going to try to inject new momentum in this process. But I think China also wants to give North Korea some easy victories now and to continue to encourage them down this path of diplomacy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that relationship, because President Trump has asserted that, in fact, President Xi is helping in the North Korea disarmament and nuclear disarmament process, and even in the diplomatic realm. But others suggest that Xi is using North Korea as a wedge to actually leverage the relationship with President Trump and with the United States. How do you see the Xi-Kim Jong-un United States triangle?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of both, really. That, I mean, Xi Jinping, no one in Asia wants North Korea with nuclear weapons and using them willy-nilly. So, I mean, everybody wants things to cool down. I mean, ideally denuclearization, but under lock and key, if not. So everybody shares that same interest. But Xi Jinping has his own strategic interest there. He wants Kim Jong-un or the regime to stay in place. He does not want any turmoil on any of the borders. So, and I think as well that he was quite alarmed. Xi Jinping ignored Kim Jong-un for 6 years, and then all of a sudden this diplomatic process started and threatened to take off without him. So I think he very much wants to insert himself into this process and make sure that he is the one who has an influence over Kim Jong-un, not Donald Trump. You know, he is the one who has the influence in Asia more broadly. So I think that's his number one priority. He wants to be involved in this and to be in the driver's seat. But the trade war has really sapped China's incentive to do anything to help the United States right now. You know, beyond what Xi Jinping will do what's in his interest, but nothing more. He's not going to help Donald Trump there, I think, because this trade war between the United States and China has become so protracted and no end in sight. And yeah, that is bedeviling, I guess, other relations, other things.
But looking at China, you know, traditionally, from the West, we've often assumed that really North Korea could make no moves without China's acquiescence to allowing it to do that. But you draw a very different picture, I think, in your book, asserting a certain level of autonomy mm-hmm. over North Korea's actions, whereas I think the criticism has often been that that North Korea does China's bidding regardless of what North Korea thinks or wants. Mm-hmm. Could you draw that out a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, Xi Jinping has no love lost for Kim Jong-un whatsoever. I mean, there's a reason he hasn't really talked to him for 6 years. The Chinese in general were very angry when Kim Jong-un had his uncle killed, the uncle Zhang, who was in charge of economic relations with China and had a lot of good ties in China. He'd even met President Hu Jintao there. And that led to a real chilling of relations between China and North Korea. But, you know, Kim Jong-un's first years in power, not only did he ignore Xi Jinping, but he actively sought to embarrass him or humiliate him. So he fired missiles during the first Belt and Road Forum. And during the G20 summit, he fired missiles that could have the city where it was being held within range. And he did most of these things with impunity. You know, Xi Jinping was very unhappy, but he couldn't do much about it. So I think he got away with a lot at that time. Now, I mean, China does have a lot of leverage over North Korea because so much of the trade goes back and forth. 90% of North Korean trade goes to or through China. So if Xi Jinping wanted to stop that, he could inflict pain on North Korea. But his priority has always been stability there. So while China has been implementing the sanctions to a surprisingly strong degree, they're still letting enough get through so that the regime doesn't collapse. And I think, you know, that is, they're still letting the pressure out. But from North Korea's perspective, they really resent their dependence on China. They hate that China does have this leverage over them and have been trying to diversify their partners. And so like in 2015, it was the year of North Korean-Russian friendship. And he's tried to develop relations there, but also with countries in Southeast Asia and around the place. So China still is number one, but yes, they are trying to diversify.
Could you talk a bit about the relationship between Putin and Kim Jong-un?
Yeah, I mean, the North Korean nuclear scientists learn everything in Russia. They went to Dubna, to the nuclear facility. So a lot of this comes from Russia and Ukraine, their know-how. Putin has been very clear in how he thinks about this process and, you know, memorably said Kim Jong-un will let North Koreans eat grass before he gives up this nuclear program. You know, the message was that the sanctions will not work, which is very similar to what the Chinese have basically been saying. Now, I mean, Putin, I think, is so eager for friends that even Kim Jong-un has counted as a friend in this case, right? And he's been happy to have that summit. But also from Kim Jong-un's perspective, as he's making this his debut into the world and trying to make this metamorphosis into a respected international statesman, it's very convenient for him to have these meetings, including with Putin in Vladivostok, though that meeting was very short in both time and in substance. But still, he got a photo for the front page of the North Korean state newspaper, which is what he wanted from that. I think he sees this as a very practical relationship. You know, Russia is on the Security Council and has spoken that about sanctions should be lifted because North Korea has stopped testing. There are at least 50,000 North Korean workers in Russia. There's a lot of men who are working in as lumberjacks, you know, in the timber industry and also in the construction industry in Moscow and St. Petersburg. And these people are a huge source of income for the North Korean regime. So I think from Kim Jong-un's perspective, that is a way to shore up that relationship and to make sure that those people can stay in Russia and continue to earn hundreds of millions of dollars for the regime despite the sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Well, South Korea, looking at border states, North Korea shares a border with South Korea, a demilitarized border, but a tense border regardless. Because of the summits, the relationships have grown warmer. South Korea has opened what could be the equivalent of an embassy in North Korea, sort of an interest section, but I think it's understood to be something that's been very forward diplomatically. And is there a possibility that the game is now being played between North and South Korea and that the other powers are really just following along?
You know, South Korea did not sign the armistice agreement that ended the Korean War in 1953. America signed on its behalf. So this is all very much aimed at the United States. The South Korean president has been very forward-leaning in trying to engage North Korea and encourage North Korea, but he is constrained by sanctions. You know, there are so many things that he wants to do in terms of restarting economic cooperation and things that he cannot do while the sanctions are in place. And North Korea has a way of kind of putting South Korea in a difficult position. It enjoys doing that, I think, to try to make them pick sides between the United States and North Korea. So it's a balancing act for them. But they're a law-abiding country. They're not going to breach the sanctions. They'll just try and be creative.
Okay. Well, of course, nuclear weapons are not the only offensive capabilities that North Korea has. The Sony hack, following the movie The Dictator, which I assume Kim Jong-un may have seen on DVD, led to some significant disruption in the United States.
Yeah.
What types of cyber capacities do they have, and how is it that they develop such an advanced capability to be able to go so far in the world with these tools?
Yeah, I think this is often underestimated because while they, you know, the nuclear program gets a lot of headlines and they issue a lot of threats, they know that they can't actually use this offensively. But they really are using their cyber army offensively and getting away with it largely because it's not, there's a lot of code and stuff I don't understand that points back to North Korea, but they have not really been punished for it. And they have been very active. So there have been a lot of cyber attacks in South Korea. And also this very brazen heist on the Central Bank of Bangladesh, where North Korea got $81 million before it was intercepted. So they've earned a lot of money, caused a lot of disruption. The whole, there was a ransomware hack that brought down the British healthcare system. They've been very active, and I think we should be much more worried about that they really are using that. And it's difficult to crack down on because we don't know where they are. We don't know how they're doing it. The assumption is that there are a lot of people in China who are working on this, but it's a difficult thing to try to stop.
Right, and this is going to be key because we're not always able to identify who the attackers are, right? There's this question of where do the attacks come from? Mm-hmm. And so they could launch without us necessarily knowing it. Let's return to the focus of your book, which is Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. And it's often said that he is looked upon, or at least the Kim dynasty and the Kim leadership, were looked on as deities, as that they are these godlike mm-hmm. figures. How do you get from being a freedom fighter or whatever you want to consider his grandfather
yeah.
to being considered a god with whatever mythology is drawn around that that personage?
Yeah. I mean, the Soviets were also wondering this in the 50s, I think. Like once Kim Il-sung became the founding president of North Korea in 1948, he did it with the backing of Stalin and the Soviet Union. And it was supposed to be a client state, but it didn't take long for Kim Il-sung to start this cult of personality around him, which, you know, put even Stalin in the shade and Mao Zedong in the shade. It was so over the top. He had this very exaggerated biography as being an anti-Japanese fighter. You know, it was exaggerated over the course of time. But once he decided to hand down power to his son, Kim Jong-il, he started to create a myth about the family descending from Mount Paektu, which is this holy mountain that's supposed to be the home of all Korean people in the north of North Korea. And so they started propagating this myth of the Paektu bloodline. And when Kim Jong-il was named as the successor to his father, The propagandists came up with the story that he was born on Mount Paektu. I mean, in fact, he was born in a camp in the Soviet Union. Born on Mount Paektu, and a bright star shone in the sky at night. You know, North Korea has this long history of Christianity. I think they borrowed quite a few stories at the time.
It's a popular one.
Yeah, right. But having banned religion, they thought that chances are people would not hear about the other version of that story. But then they started, propagating this idea that they were these quasi-deities come down from Mount Paektu. And that has been amped up under Kim Jong-un. He also claims to have this Paektu blood running through his veins, and that gives him this divine right to lead North Korea. And that's also why he had his own half-brother assassinated, because even though Kim Jong-nam had no interest in running North Korea, he technically has the bloodline through which the Kims claim their legitimacy, so could technically pose a challenge to Kim Jong-un because of that.
Right. So they've drawn this picture, they've created this mythology. Do the people believe it, do you think? I mean, I know it's hard to talk to the man on the street in North Korea. In fact, probably
impossible.
Yeah, impossible. It probably is more dangerous for them than it is for you.
Yeah, so it is impossible to talk to North Koreans inside North Korea about anything, you know, about anything really, but certainly not about something like this. I mean, that would be a death sentence for them, and I would just never do it. But I have talked, or never try even, I have talked to a lot of North Koreans who have escaped, and I have tried to find very recent escapees. And so in China, on the border with North Korea, there's a lot of North Koreans living in hiding, but I've also found people in Laos and Thailand on the escape route out to South Korea. I've interviewed people who've left 1 week before, so very, very fresh testimony of what life is like in North Korea. And yeah, those people know that it's all lies. They say, you know, like the stories don't make sense to them as well. Even some of the most basic things, like how Kim Jong-un was supposed to be able to fire a gun at the age of 7 and hit a light bulb 100 yards away. And things. Like every man in North Korea has been in the military. They know a 7-year-old can't fire a gun. So they like just the little seeds of doubt like this start to settle into their minds. So I think a lot of people now know that it's all lies. And certainly even more people know that North Korea is not the socialist paradise it's cracked up to be, because there's now a lot of information that's getting into North Korea through on USB sticks and SD cards. Everybody has seen South Korean movies and dramas and Chinese ones too. So they know. And I often ask people who have escaped, like, why do North Koreans not rise up and protest against their leader? And she said it's because, I mean, the system is so repressive. If you are deemed to have committed a political crime in North Korea, which can be like questioning Kim Jong-un's right to rule the country, questioning why North Korea is spending all the money on the nuclear program instead of, say, on food, that can have the perpetrator sent to a political prison camp in the mountains, potentially for the rest of their life. And North Korea doesn't just send the so-called perpetrator, it sends three generations of their family with them. So you may be willing to risk your life to criticize the regime, but are you prepared to have your parents and your spouse and your children also sent to a hard labor camp in the mountains, you know, to work in a mine and have no food for the rest of their lives? You know, the answer for most people is no, of course. And so this woman, I would remember asking her about that. And she said, in North Korea, if you disagree with the system, you try to escape. You don't try to change it. And I think that is what people do. They try to escape if they can.
And when they do, are there repercussions for their families three generations back if these family members have left the country?
It depends. Generally not the three generations for that kind of crime. Most people I've talked to have just talked about being denied opportunities and jobs, you know, their political status. They go down a few pegs or two or five. But if somebody just disappears in the middle of the night and is never seen again, you know, you can keep up the ruse that they're in China earning money for the family. And that's okay. It's not as severe in North Korean terms. A lot of people are doing that. But if it is proven that that person has gone to South Korea and is living in South Korea, that's when it becomes much more politically difficult. So that's why all of the people I've interviewed in South Korea, I make sure to never include any identifying information about them because they are very worried about their families back home, that they will be punished if it's known that they really are in South Korea.
And they may be worried for themselves. I mean, there is a tradition of North Koreans actually doing having extraterritorial attacks on individuals.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there have been a lot of attempted attacks and a couple of successful ones in South Korea. So yes, they would be worried about that. And when we look at somebody like Tae Yong-ho, who was the North Korean diplomat who defected from London, you know, he is very critical of the regime now, and he has like six or seven bodyguards with him at all times. So he is in a very precarious situation and can't live a normal life now.
Right, and of course you mentioned earlier his half-brother, the Kim Jong-un's half-brother, who was killed outside of North Korea,
yep.
Of course. But of course, the president of the United States will not endanger any more of the family members living outside of the country.
I know.
What do you think of that? That pronouncement that he would not make that type of an act or use that type of a relationship to get intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, astounding. Like, there is almost no human intelligence on North Korea. So the fact that the CIA was able to recruit Kim Jong-un's half-brother as an informant was a major victory for them. And even though Kim Jong-nam had no relationship with his brother, he still did have contacts at the top of the regime with other powerful people in the regime. So he could have been a useful source of information about Kim Jong-un and how he runs the operation. The president to suggest he wouldn't do that, wouldn't try to find out more about his negotiating partner, wouldn't try to find more of somebody who could immediately go back to testing nukes and missiles. Yeah, it's pretty shocking.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned in your book that Kim Jong-un actually flies a plane, and
he
flies it to his beach chalet out in this wonderful little area.
Not chalet, it's a palace.
It's a palace. So what's the deal with trains in North Koreans? Why do they always travel in trains? Why, this is not just true for Kim Jong-un. I mean, that's a long train ride to get to Vietnam.
60 hours.
Yes.
He upset all the train traffic in China for a long time. I think that's very much about his recreating his grandfather's image. You know, his grandfather traveled on train. It may have just been practical because he had so much stuff to take there. I mean, he didn't stop off in China, so it was surprising. But yeah, he likes trains as well. They have armored trains. Maybe he didn't want to borrow a Chinese plane again. You know, he borrowed Lee Ke-chung's plane to go to Singapore for the first summit. So maybe that would be too humiliating for him to have to do it again. He flies a little Cessna kind of thing around North Korea.
We've been hearing from Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post, Anna Fifield. She's written a new book on Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea. After the break, join us for the second half of the conversation. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Anna Fifield. She's the Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcus Kounalakis. To hear this program or any other World Affairs, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
Well, we're going to take some questions from the audience, and this one's from Chloe, and she asks, what could a new U.S. administration mean for U.S.-North Korean relations? Have any presidential candidates addressed North Korea?
Oh, wow. I mean, an impossible question to answer, because there's, what, how many Democratic nominees now? Like 24 or something?
Yes, I think, yeah, as of today, yes.
I mean, it's very difficult to say because some of them we know about. We've heard Joe Biden talk about North Korea before and things, but it's too hypothetical, I think, to answer what it would be. I do think that the North Koreans are very happy that Hillary Clinton didn't win, because I think while she's a known quantity, they would have known that she would be very hardline and unwilling to do the kind of things that Trump is now doing. So I think they're probably happy with Trump and would like to keep him there.
Right. In fact, we've got a couple of questions here about President Trump, and you've spoken. You've suggested that, you know, at least he's trying something new and that this is a positive thing. Diplomatic relations have improved. We're able to at least have a conversation. Some of the audience ask things like, do you think President Trump wants to build a personal relationship with North Korean leader? If so, why? And then how did Kim Jong-un respond to being called Little Rocket Man?
Okay, that's easy. He responded to Little Rocket Man by calling Donald Trump mentally deranged,
yes,
and a dotard, which sent everybody to their dictionaries. People have met their match when they try to challenge the North Korean state media for their flowery words and insults. They are the masters. So that was very much during this back and forth war of words at that time. Now it's all beautiful love letters and, things have changed since those days. I think that Trump really believes in his ability to forge a personal relationship with a whole variety of totalitarian style leaders, not just Donald Trump, and that he has done that. But also, like, from the North Korean side, this is really a one-man regime. Kim Jong-un is in charge, and if Kim Jong-un decides he wants to do something, everybody else puts that in train. And we could see that his negotiators were really constrained during the preparations for the summits. And before the first summit, they would come to the DMZ between North and South Korea, and they'd have to go back to Pyongyang all the time to seek further guidance on the smallest of things. So he is really in the driver's seat and really was involved in every single nitty-gritty aspect of these negotiations. So that's part of the reason I think that maybe leadership level can work relatively fruitfully under these two unconventional leaders.
Right. So many in foreign policy disparage the great man theory and the role that individuals can play. Yeah. You feel that in this case, it actually is very important.
Yeah. I mean, I get why they disparage it, of course, and I get that it's very unconventional and not the way things are usually done. And I don't for a second think that Donald Trump has got this mapped out tactically, and because he's learned so much about North Korea, I think it's just kind of fortuitous that it's working out this way. But maybe they can make some progress on it because of these, you know, because he's somebody who follows his gut, not his advisors. And even after, I mean, the surprising thing, right, even after the collapse of the Hanoi summit, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un both keep talking about how committed they are to this process and trying to get back to talks. You know, John Bolton must be wringing his hands in the wings, thinking, why is Trump not seeing Kim Jong-un for what he really is? But they are still making very conciliatory noises about this. And neither of them has insulted the other leader during this whole process. So, I mean, North Korea is insulting Bolton left, right, and center, but not Trump.
Mandy from USF asks, on what terms do you think a deal could be struck between the U.S., North Korea, South Korea, China, and Japan? And she's including everybody here because it sounds like she's looking for a multilateral deal
rather than a bilateral.
Right, and
Russia was the other member
of
Russia
there too.
Six-party talks.
Yes.
I mean, this is, yes, China, I mean, the people want this multilateral process, but the problem really is between the U.S. and North Korea, and nothing will get fixed until that is resolved. You know, I think this is the part where I say I'm happy I'm a journalist and not a diplomat. I just get to write about it and not solve the problems. But I do think that they need to take baby steps towards this and do pick some of the easy stuff, the low-hanging fruit first. That's why I think, yes, interest section or a liaison office and some educational sporting exchanges, just more contact might be a way to make it easier for the two sides to talk about the more difficult stuff. Because, yeah, the difficult stuff is really hard.
Well, you are a journalist and not a diplomat, and so you can't be PNG'd, as they say. You are not persona non grata, but you can be denied visas to North Korea. And apparently someone heard you on another program talking about not returning to North Korea, certainly not anytime soon.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about why that process? I mean, clearly you've written a book and you've attracted some attention and you're here on stage talking and quite critically about North Korea. But is there, what is it you would fear by going?
I mean, North Korea hasn't let me in for a couple of years anyway because they don't like my reporting, but I don't need them to like my reporting. I just need to write what I need to write. But now, I mean, so it's kind of a moot question. They're not letting me in anyway. But I would be worried. You know, it's one thing to write critically about North Korea. It's another thing to focus on the leader. You know, that is really the third rail of North Korea and something that they would just not tolerate. And so the times that we've seen North Korea kind of come out and be proactive and talking to the outside world have been like the times after the United Nations Commission of Inquiry recommended that Kim Jong-un be referred to the International Criminal Court for Crimes Against Humanity. And when he was individually singled out and named for that, the North Koreans, you know, they know that they have to go out there and defend their leader, the North Korean diplomats. So I think that they would be quite, they will not like this book, of course. And so I would just not go back to North Korea. I think that, yeah, it could be dangerous.
Well, related, someone in the audience, and we've got an audience of over 100 in here, and someone asks, do you believe there are any North Korean operatives in the audience? Turn to the person next to you.
I do not believe there are any North Korean operatives in the audience. No. I mean, I did wonder when I did a talk in New York if the North Koreans at the UN might come and listen to me. They did not. So, yeah, I'm sure they're watching.
They are. You know, did you ever read, so I know you really looked at everything when you were doing this book, and every strand of a potential lead led you to follow up. Did you ever see this book called Pyongyang, which was a graphic novel?
Yes, Guy Delisle,
yes.
The Canadian cartoon. Yes,
yes.
Fantastic. I read that a long time ago, and I thought it captured so much about North Korea that is impossible to put into words.
It was fabulous, and it literally drew a very stark picture of Pyongyang and the depraved sort of nature of it and the poverty of the city. You've, in your most recent visits, draw a different picture. It's not nearly as stark or as impoverished or as colorless as I think that book drew Pyongyang at the time.
Right, that book's quite old now, though. It's like maybe 2005 or 8 or something back then.
Quite good.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah.
He's written other cartoons about other cities, too. North Korea, I mean, Pyongyang has changed a lot under Kim Jong-un. He's really put a lot of effort into making the showcase capital feel and look a lot better so that the elites who live there and keep him in power feel like their lives are getting better, feel like their standards of living are rising. There's now skyscraper or high-rise apartment buildings and supermarkets selling imported food and cafes and gyms and all sorts of things in Pyongyang that you would expect to see in other Asian capitals. So much so that some people call it Pyonghattan because it has changed so much. So much of it, like so much in North Korea, is cosmetic. Like I've been into some of these apartment towers, and when you get up close, even the new ones, you can see the tiles are falling off, or there's not enough electricity to operate the elevators. So if you live on the 25th floor, you've got to walk up. So people in North Korea want to live on the low floors of these buildings, not the high floors. It's the opposite from everywhere else. So a lot of it is cosmetic, but some of it is real. People do in Pyongyang have more disposable income than before, because Kim Jong-un has allowed them to become corrupt, to use their positions to make money on the side, to use their ability to travel, to trade, and to siphon off money for themselves. And so this has improved the standard of living there for the 1% in Pyongyang. And he's done that on purpose, because those are the people who keep him in power. It's the elites at the top who support the regime. He doesn't care about the masses. They are powerless, and their standard of living has improved like a tiny wee bit because he's allowed markets to open in North Korea. But it's all under their own steam. It's all because of their own enterprise. They get nothing from the system.
This 1%, are they allowed also foreign travel?
Some of them, yeah. If they work in a ministry that has foreign, like the trade ministry, or if they're in the military doing construction contracts with China, there are quite a few people who are allowed to travel. I met one man who had worked in Office 39, which is the department that raises money directly for the Kim family. And his children had gone to university in China with him, and they went back and forth, and their friends would send them shopping lists of, we want clothes from Zara and H&M, and, please bring us this. And there is conspicuous consumption now. They have this standard of living that they could not have dreamed of 10 years ago. And that's by design. Like Kim Jong-un knows that these millennials in particular are the ones who could keep him in power for decades to come. So he's made sure that they in particular have a better standard of living.
Right. And up until the recent sanctions, which have tightened things up for them, they had to earn revenue from elsewhere to be able to import certain goods. My understanding is that arms were a big part of the export business and a big part of the revenue generation. Mm-hmm. What types of, we often hear about their missile technology going elsewhere. Yeah. Who were their customers?
Yeah, I mean, one of the really surprising things is that a lot of this illicit activity that they used to do we don't hear about this anymore. Right. I think it's dried up. So they used to counterfeit a lot of US $100 notes, super dollars, very good copies. Apparently they did that. They were selling drugs. You know, North Korean diplomats would be caught in Eastern Europe with a trunk full of heroin or fake cigarettes and things. There was a case a little while ago where some arms parts were intercepted in a ship bound, well, there was one in Mexico and one going through the Suez Canal. But it's relatively rare from before, which does raise the question, like, how are they earning all this money?
Or have they just gotten better at getting it out of the country?
Maybe. I mean, yeah, maybe they've gotten better at subterfuge. But I think that a lot of it is that they don't need to anymore because there's been this huge explosion in labor exports under Kim Jong-un. There's now maybe 100,000 North Koreans who go out into the outside world. And I went into a factory in China where North Korean women were working, making garments, making clothes. And they were making these trousers when I was there for a Japanese company and sewing in, you know, made in China labels into these pants that would then go off to be sold as made in China. So they are doing a lot of this kind of work. And the regime earns more than $1 billion a year from this because the wages from the workers, 2/3 of it goes to the regime and 1/3 the person, you know, technically is supposed to be able to keep for themselves.
Right. And they were able to use their diplomatic missions as essentially retail outlets for some of their goods. Is
yeah.
That right?
The embassies are supposed to be self-funding. Mm-hmm. So the diplomats are charged with raising enough money to keep the embassy afloat and to... Yeah, keep them afloat.
To the point where they're actually running restaurants and things of that sort. Fabulous. Your own P&L as a diplomat, yes. you know, we started this talk about basketball, and I think one of the most fascinating series of anecdotes about Kim Jong-un is really, and you know, we're just finished the NBA Finals where the Warriors lost to a foreign country. Maybe North Korea will eventually have an NBA team. Yeah. Could you talk a bit about Kim Jong-un and his basketball fetish and focus and interest? And I guess at some point, drop in a little bit about Dennis Rodman.
Of course, yeah. So this was his mother's influence on him. So Kim Jong-un as a child was really into trains and planes and was obsessive about making models and things like this. And his mother thought that it was quite unhealthy that he was so obsessed with this and that he needed to get out more. So there is a belief in South Korea and North Korea that if you play basketball, you will grow taller. So his mother encouraged him to take up basketball, you know, and maybe it worked because he is a few inches taller than his father. She channeled him into this and he did become a really ardent fan as a child. And in Switzerland, he used to sleep with his basketball in his bed, you know, probably similar to many American children do. And that so it started back then, but he really is a serious fan of the NBA. And so when he took over as the leader, serious people, including some people in the CIA, talked about trying to send a Chicago Bull to North Korea as an envoy because Kim Jong-un was a Chicago Bull fan in particular because they were so huge in the 90s when he was in Switzerland. This idea went nowhere until Vice News came along and came up with the idea of taking a Chicago Bull as a ticket to get into North Korea. Which as a journalist, I think, you know, genius move. Yeah. They tried to get Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan, for whatever reason, you know, did not think this was a good idea to go play basketball with Kim Jong-un or for Kim Jong-un. But they did get Dennis Rodman, another unconventional character in our cast of characters here. And he was up for it. And off he went to North Korea. On the first trip, when Vice Media was there, he had arranged to take 3 Harlem Globetrotters with him because he thought that having, you know, their on-court antics would make basketball more accessible for the North Korean audience and would just be more entertainment. Kim Jong-un apparently hated this. He hated the players hanging from the hoops and all this kind of stuff because he wanted a serious game. So the next time Dennis Rodman went back, he took these retired All-Stars with him and they did play a much more serious game and they played like... you know, where they picked from both sides. I can't remember what that's called. And the North Koreans, you know, beat the Americans at that time when they were playing each other because, yeah, they were young and fit and fast. But yeah, just the tales I heard from those trips were really astounding. Like Kim Jong-un singing karaoke, James Brown during this. Like Dennis Rodman's entourage got so out of control that Dennis Rodman told them to calm it down a bit there. So just, you know, and these people who went there, you know, journalists are like, oh, if I was being a good journalist, I should have stayed sober and written everything down. But they didn't, but they remembered it. But just fascinating to think that Kim Jong-un allowed this, that he seemed to enjoy it, and also that he did share a lot of these trips with the North Korean people. So this is a regime that has founded an opposition to the cunning American bastards, as they're called, and all the propaganda. Like, America is the enemy of the United of the North Korean regime. And then Kim Jong-un's on the front page of the newspaper, standing next to not just an American, but an American who fully embraces his right to self-expression. You know, he's piercings and tattoos and a hat, and I don't know how Kim Jong-un got away with it, especially with the old guard. I mean, it shows how confident he is, I think, in his hold over the regime, that he was willing to do this despite, I'm sure, the objections of the octogenarians who've been serving in that regime for many years.
Well, when I lived in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe in some of these communist areas, basketball was often used in a racial way. And so the allowance of having African Americans allowed those communist regimes to talk about the inequality that exists within American society. Was there any of that, do you think, within the North Korean, in terms of him getting away with it with the old guard?
I doubt it. I think in that situation we never heard any discussion of race. I think in that situation, Americans are all Americans. But North Korea has really seized on some aspects of American social problems. I mean, often, or from time to time in their media, they will talk about gun violence in the United States. They talked about some of the killings of young black men and talked about how unequal and dysfunctional, basically, the United States is. And so they did that obviously to show a weakness of the United States, but generally they always seize on events in other countries, especially natural disasters. Anytime there's floods and things in other countries, they report it in their media because they want to try to say, see, things are much worse in other countries. It's not just us, because North Korea does suffer a lot from torrential rain and things like the famine happened as a result of drought and then floods. So
right,
they do try to exaggerate other natural disasters.
And even emphasize it. At one point in your book, you talk about them sending food aid to South Korea.
Yeah, that was at the beginning, yeah.
During a time of privation within their own country.
That's right. I mean, it's all part of the propaganda. So when I have been to North Korea, you know, they put on, it's really embarrassing and awful, like they put on so much food for the visitors because it's a form of propaganda. They want to say, look how much we have. So when I went with like a plane load of Americans for the New York Philharmonic trip, it was like the most elaborate buffet I've seen anywhere in the world, I think. And it's really galling.
Well, look, it's been great. I know you're going to do some terrific reporting from Beijing. We're looking forward to maybe the next book that you come out with, whoever it is you may be profiling and psychographically analyzing. But what you've done to expose us and to enlighten us about this hermit kingdom has been terrific. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Anna Fifield. She's the Beijing Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. She's also the author of a new book, The Great Successor, The Divinely Perfect Destiny of Brilliant Comrade Jong-un. This program was moderated by my co-host, Marcus Kounoulakis. On the next episode of World Affairs,
the power to influence how people think is many times more dangerous than we realize.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, you say something often enough and people will either believe it or they will at least doubt what they do believe. And we're all, I think, prey to that. And so the ability to leverage modern information technology is something we haven't gotten our heads around yet.
World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. Our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.